From WNYC, this is The Sporkful.
I gotta level with you, friends. Math was never my strong suit. In fact, in college, I went to ridiculous lengths to circumvent the math requirement as best I could. All the computer science classes counted towards the math requirement, and they had one class that they were phasing out called HyperCard. And they had another class that they were bringing in called Computing on the Internet. Is that how old I am? Yeah, that's right. I'm that old. Yeah. And there was overlap. Half of each class was the same. And they were being offered both in the same semester for one final time before HyperCard was eliminated. I still don't know what a HyperCard is. But I went into the comp sci department and I went to a professor there and I said, can I take HyperCard and Computing on the Internet in the same semester and be done with my math requirement? And the professor stopped and he thought for a minute and he said, well, I guess technically we can't stop you. And that was all I needed to hear. I was off and running. So needless to say, I never loved math. But in my old age, I have come to appreciate some of its wonderful applications. And I always did have a soft spot for geometry. And geometry certainly comes into play when you talk about sandwiches. I'm sure you knew that's where this was going, right? And this was the topic of conversation when I sat down with Robert Krulwich from WNYC's Radio Lab and my friend Mark Garrison from Marketplace. And we were talking about this. Let's say you take a sandwich on standard issue supermarket white bread and you slice it in half diagonally. One half of that sandwich is a right triangle. It's got the 90-degree angle. It's got the two pointy acute angles. And it's got the hypotenuse, the longest side, the part where you can see inside into the middle of the sandwich. So my question to Robert was this. Where's the best place to take the first bite? An acute angle or the hypotenuse?
For those who are little, who have trouble with geometry, what he means by the hypotenuse is he means the obvious place to eat the stupid sandwich, the big wide part where you can see everything.
The middle, the part sliced in the
middle. Yeah, that's what it is. And so, of course you eat there because A, you can look at it. B, you can choose your point of entry. C, it's that's how you do it. That's how you do it.
So you can be anywhere.
No, I've never seen anybody eat the pointy one part.
When you're saying choosing your point of entry, so you are fine with any point along the long edge.
Like, it's like a piano. You can hit any note on the keyboard. It's stretched there before you.
I don't quite understand why you would choose a bite that would put your cheeks in jeopardy of being smeared with something. And also, too, you...
It's like a kiss. If you want to kiss somebody, would you pucker, and stretch your lips as far so you got as close to a duck as you could and then take a little peck? No. You would bury yourself in the lips of the other. A sandwich is a form of comfort and addressing with ardor the meal.
Okay, so I was waiting for the romantic part
of that. Yeah, you hit the sandwich big time.
Why not choose the acute angle and then it's almost like an arrow. It's an arrow like pointing into your mouth and it goes in there perfectly. And
that's the sandwich's way of spiking. That's the sandwich saying, no, not here. That's what that is. That is the sandwich's spike. You don't approach, what are those animals with all those spikes?
Porcupines.
You don't approach a porcupine spike word. You only address it from the head where it's not spiky.
So you only kiss a porcupine on the lips.
That's right.
That's good advice in general, I think, in life. But
words to live by.
Have you
question.
Ever eaten a sandwich from the bottom, from the pointy side?
Yes,
I have. Absolutely,
have? That is
sure.
My preferred way. I mean, I'm not.
Wait, no.
In general,
you always eat them that way.
I do like starting with that point.
I've never seen this.
Here's my other question, Robert: is that you say that the only way, if you have a square sandwich on white or wheat sliced bread, the only way to do it is to cut it diagonally?
Yes.
The difference between cutting it diagonally and cutting it across the middle.
No one cuts it across. Well,
it's been done. It's been
the
done.
The difference between if you're going to bite into the center.
Yes.
Then there's no difference in cutting it diagonally or cutting it across the middle. The only reason to cut it diagonally is to create the points.
The sandwich doesn't want to be eaten. And you are expecting the sandwich to cut on the diagonal, so the sandwich can announce with your help where it does not want to be eaten.
Well, friends, if you enjoy listening to Robert Krulwich talk about sandwich science as much as I do, Stay tuned. Later in the show, we'll discuss force equals mass times acceleration. In other words, how do you build a sandwich so that the force of the bite doesn't cause the mass of the sandwich to accelerate out the back? Plus, I'll argue with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow over whether you're supposed to eat the olives in a martini. I was shocked by her response. And Slate's Julia Turner and I discuss which pasta shapes should be abolished. Spoiler alert, you're going down, wagon wheel. It's going to be a good one. Stay with us. From WNYC, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and this is our all-star book release spectacular edition of The Sporkful. I am so, so excited this week, and I hope you don't mind me saying it, friends, but I'm also feeling really proud because this week we mark the release of the first ever Sporkful book, my first ever book. It's called Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious, and it's the culmination of, geez, about 3 years of work on the book, 5 years of work on this podcast. I mean, this is like the culmination of all that work. And I should add, 37 years spent eating. And, you know, when I first started the Sporkful podcast, it was kind of a side project that I was doing nights and weekends. I had worked a bunch of different jobs in media, worked on a lot of shows that for a wide variety of reasons kept getting canceled. And I sort of figured, well, if I start my own podcast, at least that way the only one who can cancel it is me. And here I am 5 years later, still not canceled. But we started the podcast and really connected with people, connected with you guys. And the thing has taken off. And this book is sort of like our greatest accomplishment. And when I say our accomplishment, I really mean that because I should say, you know, all the guests and the topics that are featured here in this episode of The Sporkful today are all in the book, but they aren't the only ones. You guys are in this book because so many of you helped as recipe testers and are acknowledged in the back of the book as a result. You know, I think of the Schultz family in Wilmington, North Carolina, Laura and David and their kids, Alex and Annabelle. They helped test the Cube Farm tiramisu, which is a way to make tiramisu using only the ingredients in your office vending machine and your free office coffee. And they tested it and retested it till we got it right. I think of Allison Ruggieri in Haley, Idaho, and her kids, Emmett and Owen. They helped test a technique where you spread peanut butter on top of a waffle to ward off syrup-induced soggage. And Allison sent me a note. She said, this idea is worth the price of your book. So I'm excited, and I hope that you're excited too, friends. The book, again, is called Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. It's available wherever books are sold and at Sporkful.com. Now, let's continue the celebration with Slate's Julia Turner. We got a lot to cover here on pasta, and we're not going to get into sauces because that's a whole other situation. But perhaps it will help our discussion if I divide pastas into two basic categories, what I would call basically long and short, but I'll call them strands and pieces.
Okay.
Strands are your linguine, fettuccine, spaghetti. Pieces are like your bow tie, rigatoni, ziti.
Can I confess before we really get into the nitty gritty here?
Please.
I'm just going to open the show with a strong gambit. Worst pasta shape of all time, the wagon wheel. Definitely the wagon wheel we can just get rid of and throw out completely. Those things, they never cook right. They're always like uncooked at the hinges. You know the ones I mean, like the little wagon wheel kid pastas. You can string them up on your fork a dime a dozen, but then you've got this soggy mush between the undercooked hinges. Poof. And they don't hold sauce for bupkis. I mean,
I'm with you 100%. I think the wagon wheel is terrible. So in general, though, I mean, do you think, should there be contraction in the pasta shaped community?
Apart from the wagon wheel, I'm not sure. There are a couple others that I would make a case for throwing out. So I could see the case for skimming. On the other hand, I would like to see new pasta shapes. I think let 1,000 pasta shapes bloom. Let's get rid of some of the underperformers and see what we can do with some new stuff. Every time I discover a new pasta shape, I'm always curious to learn about its properties, see what it can do for me. And, you know, often you find that it does something with a sauce that you like different than your old familiars, and you might want to work it into the routine. I remember having an experience where I was cooked a green tomato pasta, where you just take green tomatoes at the end, but not too far toward the end of summer, and cook it way, way down with a lot of onions. And they were served with bucatini, which are in your long or strand category, they're like a really fat spaghetti with a hole in it, like a straw. And so the sauce kind of penetrates the interior of the fat spaghetti. It's a really interesting pasta shape. I almost never cook it because it's so fat and unwieldy that when you flip it around a fork, it just sprays sauce everywhere. But I'm glad bucatini exists. And there are sauces that I like to eat bucatini with. So I wouldn't want to see bucatini go away just for some kind of pasta standardization initiative.
Well, and I also think bucatini does have an interesting and good reason for existing, which is that when you are sort of sucking down a long strand, sort of Lady and the Tramp style, even if there's no one on the other end of it, it can be hard to breathe. And bucatini allows you to breathe while sucking in the pasta strand. And so you could suck in almost an infinitely long strand of bucatini because you'd never need to stop to breathe.
Depending on the sauce, maybe that hole is so larded up with sauce, you're in, at risk of aspirating your cacio e pepe or whatever.
But. Right. I think that there are too many pasta shapes. I often find that when I try to buy pasta at the store, I'm flummoxed by the paradox of choice. And a lot of them seem the same. One that I will put on the chopping block is ziti. I think that it's not the right pasta for pretty much anything. It's not good for, it's not even good for baked ziti.
What would you make your baked ziti with?
Rigatoni, which has ridges along the outside.
Oh yeah, ziti is the unridged version?
Ziti is unridged, and so it doesn't hold sauce. You need the ridges along the exterior because that increases the surface area to volume ratio of the pasta and allows sauce to stick to it more effectively.
I agree. Yeah, the smooth ziti, that's not where you want to be. You don't want to be eating that pasta. All right, throw that out with the wagon wheels.
Okay, all right. So, but that's my point is that I feel like there have to be some out there that are just sort of like, you know, they've been grandfathered in.
Yeah.
And they're resting on their laurels.
Right.
And I think they need to prove themselves or we need to be done with them.
I think so. All right. I like it. A pasta purge.
Now let's talk a bit about the strands in more detail. I will, once again, as we go through the taxonomy of pasta, I will once again divide the strands into round strands and flat strands.
Got it.
Which do you prefer and why?
Typically flat. My baseline strand pasta is linguine. A pasta, a long strand pasta I cannot abide at all is angel hair or cappellini.
Yes.
I think that is a totally bogus pasta.
Awful.
Part of the issue, I think, is that it has too much surface area. It is the opposite problem of the ziti because it's so fine and so small. There's just so much edge to it. It just inevitably sticks. The only way to make it slidey and slimy the way you want a good pasta is by putting so much sauce or so much olive oil on it that it affects the flavor of the sauce. Cappellini, throw it out with the wagon wheels and the ziti. We're like making great progress in the pastaverse. But I love the linguine. I'm with things that are wider, like towards the fettuccine, pappardelle width, I'd rather have fresh pasta than boxed pasta. So if I'm having boxed pasta, the linguine is basically the width that I want to get to. There's a terrific line in a cookbook from Marcella Hazan, who's like the doyenne of Italian cooking, classic Italian cooking. In her carbonara recipe, she writes, "It is difficult to imagine serving carbonara on anything but spaghetti." And it's so imperious. I mean, the whole cookbook is written in that way and just part of why it's a great cookbook. But I love the imperiousness of that line. So I do, when I make carbonara, I try to pay homage to Marcella and make it with proper spaghetti. And I like the roundness of spaghetti as well. I could do spaghetti or linguine, but I did grow up on linguine.
Right. I feel a little more strongly than you do that I want flat over round, long pastas. And that is because, to me, the experience of eating pasta is so much about the way it contacts your teeth. I mean, there's a reason why they have the expression al dente, which means to the tooth. And I actually felt that way about pasta and then realized, oh, that's why they say al dente. So I want you to know that I'm not ripping off the 1,000-year-old Italian expression for quality pasta. I came to that conclusion independently. I didn't need the Italians to tell me. And so it's so much about the bite and that feeling of your teeth sinking into it. And flat pastas just fit into the bite better. They fit between your teeth in such a way. With a round pasta, less of the pasta contacts your teeth because it's literally like a round peg into a square hole, essentially.
Right.
And so I think that flat pastas are superior because they're like more al dente. They're more on your teeth.
All right, I got it. There's like a more of a density to the bite. Here's another possible advantage of the flat pasta. I do think when you're twirling the pasta around your fork, the flat pasta kind of collapses in on itself. it takes advantage of the fact that the flat sides can stack up against one another. You can make a nice, compact, dense little bite full of pasta flesh and sauce and get that into your mouth. When you're twirling around pasta, even a better basic spaghetti, much less something huge like a bucatini, it just twirls, it slides off each other. The bite doesn't stick. Like, I feel like you're more likely to have a bite that unravels. You're more likely to have a bite that, as you twirl it, is flipping sauce at your shirt. I mean, perhaps that's why Marcella and the Italians serve carbonara on spaghetti, because carbonara, since it's just a sticky sauce, it's a kind of a drier sauce, not so much of a wet sauce. Maybe it doesn't spatter as much. And if it does, you get grease stains, but you don't get tomato stains. So maybe this is the classic reason why the Italians prefer spaghetti for their carbonara. But I sort of have a sentimental Lady and the Tramp style attachment. Like, sometimes you just want a spaghetti. It's not, I think it's less optimal, but sometimes it's just fun. It feels classic. I'm actually a short shape partisan. Like, I would rather, almost always rather have a short shape than a long shape with most all pastas. Easier to eat, hold sauce better, generally delicious.
Easier to eat in what sense?
If you're having some rotini or fusilli, you can just stab them right up on your fork. They've got those nice grooves that are going to scoop up all the sauce for you. Yum, totally delicious. Penne rigate, similarly, stab, stab, stab. You've got five or six on your fork. They're not going to fall off. They got sauce in their ridges. They got sauce inside. Delicious. Gemelli, I'm a partisan of, which is sort of like a furled rotini. It's like where the rotini curls have kind of bent in on themselves.
It's like a twist or a braid kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, that's sort of a slightly denser experience, but I'll eat that with, you know, with some butter, with some pesto. I'm a short shape partisan.
I mean, to me, short shapes have their place. I do love gemelli. I'm a fan of orecchiette, the little ears.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like those take sauce very well. I think you're probably right that short shapes, it's easier to get sauce on them. Because also, once you get them on the fork, they're just less unwieldy. And
then once they're on the fork, you can kind of scoop them around the plate to kind of, you can almost create a shovel. So first you've got the tines. The tines get the pasta, the short shapes, then you scoop those short shapes around the sauce pile, get some sauce all over that, get a little mound of sauce on top of the shapes in addition to intermingled with them. That's a delicious bite right there.
It's a good bite. I can't argue against that bite. I just come back to the experience of the pasta on the tooth. And I just think that when you have a ball of long pasta wrapped around the fork, that there's nothing that compares to just the tooth sinkability of that bite. That being said, I get what you're saying.
Maybe this is why you like gemelli too, because gemelli is the densest of the short shapes.
Right, and that's why I like pappardelle. I mean, I like the pasta to be dense. I want to feel my teeth moving through the pasta. I want to feel the layers. I want the pasta to fight back.
All right, you want to subdue the pasta.
I want to master it, but not without a fight.
Okay, one more shape we have to talk about, and then we're done with shapes.
Okay.
This is another one to throw out. So inventory managers, get out your Sharpie. Bow tie.
Oh, yeah.
Worthless. Because it is a short shape, but it is hard to get on your fork. Because inevitably, when you're stabbing the center of the bow tie / butterfly, they like fall apart and split sideways. And then even if you do get a bunch on your fork and you try and slide them around your plate and do that sauce gathering maneuver, they have these floppy, sad wings off of which the sauce slides. And that's an incredibly flaccid, sad, and uninspiring bite of pasta. I would be happy to say, take the bow tie pasta, throw it out with the wagon wheel, with the ZD, just get rid of it forever.
I think part of the problem with the bow tie is that it's like it's a bow tie that hasn't been tied.
Right.
I mean, there's no proper bow center in there that's holding the thing together. So the area where the knot, the central knot of the bow tie would be, is like a nothing.
Yeah, it's sort of just like a crimped napkin.
Right, exactly. And so in reality, the bow tie is so thin, it's essentially impossible to cook it well. It's going to go from hard to soft in a split second. And it just becomes, I agree, I think it turns into mush.
Bad pasta.
That's Julia Turner. She's the editor of Slate.com and one of the hosts of Slate's excellent Culture Gabfest podcast. Coming up, are you supposed to eat the orange wedge or the pineapple wedge on a Mai Tai? Well, I asked MSNBC's Rachel Maddow that question, and let's just say that when I heard her answer, things got a little bit heated. Plus, more sandwich science with Radiolab's Robert Krulwich. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC. I'm Dan Pashman. Rachel Maddow is a deep thinker on many issues, including drinking. At MSNBC's White House Correspondents' Dinner After Party, she tends bar. When I sat down with Rachel, I began with what I thought was a simple question. How and when do you eat the olives in a martini or the cherry in a Manhattan?
I think I'm going to be able to short-circuit this entire discussion.
Okay.
You're never supposed to eat the garnish.
The
garnish is not a snack. You're not supposed to eat that little carved radish that comes on the thing that you just ordered at Applebee's. They carved it 3 days ago, and it's been on 6 different plates. You're also really not supposed to eat the thing that's not liquor in your drink. The garnish is there to modify the liquor that is in the glass. It is not there to provide you a tasty treat to go along with your drink. The drink is the treat.
Well, Rachel, I have to say, I think that a lot of people do eat the garnish and enjoy it. I'm one of those people. And I think that if you are going to eat the garnish, the best time to do it is between the one-third of the way through the drink mark and the two-thirds of the way through the drink mark.
It's impossible to do it with elegance, though, isn't it? Admit it.
Oh, sorry, Rachel. I didn't know that elegance was an issue here, okay? If elegance is an issue, well, that went out the window a long time ago.
I'm going to tie my hands behind my back and just oat bag nosedive into this thing. I mean, here's the thing is that I do most of my my cocktail drinking at home on the weekends. I have a bar at home and I make drinks. And so if I am having martinis with olives, although I'm more of a lemon twist person myself, but if I'm doing that and I want the olive, I've got olives. Because I use them to make the drink, and I will make myself a little dish of olives and have it on the side. If you want snacks, get snacks.
I guess. I really like the whole palate cleanser, change of pace in the middle of a drink. Now, what about, Rachel, the best practices for using citrus garnishes?
Citrus garnishes are a wonderful thing. What you're trying to do with a citrus garnish is express the oil from the piece of citrus onto the surface of the drink. So you don't need any of the pith, any of the pulpy part, right? You don't need any fruit, certainly, but you also don't need a very thick portion of the rind. You just want that outside part that's got the sort of oily pores on it. So really what you ought to do with the citrus garnish, like I, for example, like a lemon twist with my martini, is that you want a very thinly sliced piece of lemon rind. You spritz the oil out of that piece of rind onto the surface of the drink, and then throw it away. You don't even need to put it in the drink. There's very little additional yum that you get out of having the expressed garnish sitting in the drink. What you want is the oil.
See, like I like a gin and tonic with lime, and I like a lot of lime in my gin and tonic. I even want a little bit of lime juice from that lime wedge in my gin and tonic.
I put a bunch of lime in my gin and tonic, but you'd never use like a lime twist.
That's right. You wouldn't want a twist. I want a wedge that I can squeeze the wedge and get the juice out into my drink. I got a big problem then with the semicircle. Semicircle just falls apart in your hands. It gets all smushy and hardly any juice comes out.
Or a wheel is even worse. Oh, the wheel.
Why? Why would you ever even want it that shape?
And you know, and that's an important thing to think about with citrus garnishes, not twists, but rather having a wedge or a wheel or a wedge or a half wedge in the drink. Ideally, if the bartender knows what they're doing or if you know what you were doing while you were making your drink, the wedge of citrus, the piece of citrus is not there to allow you to recalibrate the drink because it was mixed poorly. The drink is mixed properly and the fruit is there to be a pleasing visual experience. So if you need to be squeezing more citrus into your drink because it's too sweet, that just means the drink was made wrong.
So then is a wedge a garnish?
A wedge is a garnish.
But I'm counting on that wedge.
Don't ask the bartender to put more lime juice in your gin and tonic.
But Rachel, I like having control. I want to be the one to complete the drink making process. I want to take that wedge, I want to squeeze it, and then I want to push it all the way down to the bottom of the drink to get as much citrus in there as possible.
Do you wash your hands every time before you have a drink?
Well, I'm pretty sanitary.
If you are counting on digging around in your drink to fork the garnish out when you are only one-third of the way into the drink, and you are counting on pawing your garnish, squeezing it in, and then shoving it down underneath the ice, and in between each of these things, you are paying the bartender and shaking your friend's hand and getting change and all this stuff. I mean, you're Typhoid Mary, dude.
You mean other people don't drink with their hands? That's That's Rachel Maddow. She hosts The Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC. And I should add that in the book, in Eat More Better, she also contributed a recipe for a new type of pina colada that Rachel herself created. We call it the Maddow Colada, and it is far superior and much healthier and more organic and artisanal and all those wonderful things than the traditional kind of yucky pina colada. So check that out, the Maddow Colada. Now, let's return to the topic of sandwich science with Radiolab's Robert Krulwich. Specifically, I asked Robert about that classic equation, force equals mass times acceleration. In other words, how do you build a sandwich so that the force of the bite doesn't cause the mass of the sandwich to accelerate out the back?
I think the danger area in any mixed sandwich is the slippery stuff in between. So you have to watch out for your cucumbers and you watch out for your tomatoes. Mm-hmm. These are sliding objects. Now, the breads can be an adhesive and the things you stick between can help you. But the presence of a dangerous cucumber is something to be very, very worried about, particularly with the tie, the shirt, and anything like the lap.
That's right, Robert. And this is something I've identified as the sliced cucumber conundrum.
Yeah.
And what you want to do to bring
you're very into chapter headings.
Yeah. I've seen him do this, and it's capitalized. This is
yes,
a proper
of course.
Name.
Yes. It even sounds capitalized.
It is, yes. But to bring in another scientific principle, you want to create friction. You
yes,
need
you
friction.
Do. Yes, you do.
You do not ever want tomatoes and cucumbers to be pressed up against each other. Now, in the traditional sandwich construction, oftentimes they'll go meat, then cheese, then veggies, then greens. That's normally the way they do it when they're not thinking about it. But what you should do, one way to avoid the sliced cucumber conundrum is to place the greens between the tomato and cucumber. Greens are often absorbent.
Yes.
And if you have the...
Or you could slice the greens into a shreddy, like, you know those kinds of, you know, where they take the lettuce, see the dangerous lettuce, would be the large lettuce leaf with the thick vein on top. That vein is like a track. You know, if you land on that vein, you could slide right on it. It even looks like it's inviting motion. But if you take the leaf and you grind it up into one of those, you know how,
shredded lettuce.
Think, yeah, shredded.
I think when they kind of like slice it on the meat
yeah,
slicer.
Yeah, now that's a friction. There is your stop sign
I don't
of a sandwich
know.
Right
I got
to
disagree with you there, Robert, because I find shredded lettuce has too high of a surface area to volume ratio, and it will absorb a lot of liquid, and it turns into mush, which creates a different problem.
Oh.
I think if you have... What I like to use is, let's say...
What kind of liquid would it be absorbing?
Well, liquid from the tomatoes and the cucumbers that you're trying to create friction. I prefer...
I hadn't really thought about the inner drinkingness of the sandwich. So the lettuce is drinking the tomato and then slushing up.
Exactly. And it will turn almost mealy if you have shredded lettuce. I really object to shredded lettuce in a sandwich. I go for more something like baby spinach, which is dry. It doesn't have the spines, which you were worried about, which is a valid concern, Robert.
Yeah.
And you put a little baby spinach or mesclun mix in there, and that will absorb.
Yeah. Mesclun. Now, that's a slower downer right there. Mesclun.
Yeah.
Yes. That would be a
because the little frisée in there, as a frisée is very dry.
Oh, frisée. Like frisée. If you're worried at all about slippage, then I would just stick frisée in anywhere. I would stick frisée on my lap. Yeah. Frisée is like that's a slower downer, basically.
We should make you a frisée smock, Robert, for when you eat.
No, or just like stuff your mouth with frisée and you would look like some kind of ornament.
Yeah.
And that would be, but it was an ornament that would suggest a kind of frozen in timeness, because that's what you're really up against here. You don't want accidents to happen. Slippage and all these things are things that get the better of you. And there are friendly vegetables that can hold things back. Check the action. Frisée, easily the best one.
That's the one and only Robert Krulwich from WNYC's Radio Lab. And if you are one of the very few podcast listeners on planet Earth who does not already listen to Radio Lab, you just have to check it out. It is so extraordinary and engrossing and all-consuming. You are going to fall down the Radio Lab wormhole and you may never return. But it's a really great demise, let me tell you. Find Radio Lab at radiolab.org. One more friendly reminder, folks, please go out and get the Sporkful book available now. It's called Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. It's available wherever books are sold or at Sporkful.com. And hey, if you enjoyed listening to this podcast, which I hope you did, please subscribe in iTunes. That way you can make sure to get every episode. To do that, go to iTunes.com/Sporkful. That's also, by the way, where you can get the iBooks version of my book. And finally, book tour in the works. Next few weeks, I'm going to be crisscrossing the New York area and then hitting the road. Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Chicago, LA, and San Francisco. I'm coming your way, and I would love to see you. All the dates and details are at sporkful.com. This show is a production of WNYC and The Sporkful. It's produced by Kristen Meinzer. We get web help from Talia Ralph and Alight Trong. Special thanks to Chris Bannon. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.